It's hour number four of this week's Blues Before Sunrise. It's the Blues Heritage Showcase. I'm your host, Steve Cushing. By the way, for those of you that this applies to, please keep in mind that our program this week is 6 hours long because of daylight savings time. Not everybody observes it, but some do. So for some of you, we will have 6 hours of me with blues records. Well, if you're just now joining us, what we were doing last hour is listening to an interview with Jim O'Neill, who was one of the founders and was the editor of Living Blues magazine through the 70s and into the 80s. He and his wife had the Rooster Blues label, and later he had Stackhouse Records. We're listening to an interview with Jim.
Who got away that you wish you could have caught up with?
Well, you know, we were talking about pre-war artists, and one of the reasons I didn't go to see, for instance, Memphis Minnie or Gus Channon was because I felt that had already been done, and that, you know, I should be trying to either find, if I was going to go find older artists, I should do find someone who hadn't been interviewed or documented, like Tampa Red, or for the most part, like I said, I was concentrating on the contemporary scene, who's still out there playing, who needed, because I figured those were the people that really needed our support, were the people who are still trying to make a living from it, or trying to, you know, maybe they'll never make a living from it, but at least trying to make some kind of a career from it. So I didn't get to, you know, I wish I'd, Slim Harpo died right before he was to have played at the Ann Arbor Blues Festival, and he was always one of my favorites. I really regret not ever being able to see or talk to him. Lonnie Johnson was another one from that period.
Didn't he die in, was it 70 as well?
Yeah, he died in 1970. And
my God, and then Spann and Hooker too?
Earl Hooker, Otis Spann. And Slim Harpo died just before that. J.T. Brown died around that time. Yeah, that was a batch of the early obituaries. And Brandy McGee wrote the reminiscence of Lonnie Johnson for us in Living Blues. So once in a while we would get artists to write. That was always a good thing.
Down through the course of the years that you were with the magazine, what do you think were your favorite interviews? What do you think were the best ones that you did?
Well, I was always real close to Houston Stackhouse. And he felt kind of like a grandfather to me, but it was easy just to sit around the house and talk to him because he would come to Chicago to play, and I would offer him a place to stay because he didn't want to pay the $12 hotel room that the quiet night would provide or whatever. So that made it easy just to sit and talk with him. But he would always come up. He was just a wonderful source of history and had a great way of telling stories. So I always had a fondness for him. But I was always glad that I finally got to interview Junior Wells. He was probably the blues artist I saw in Chicago more than anyone else, and although it could be the greatest show in the world or something you'd rather forget sometimes, you know, depending on what his mood was at the time, I thought he represented, you know, something that was really important and kind of that street sense of Chicago blues. And so I was happy to finally get a fairly extensive interview with him. And I had actually wanted to do one earlier, but he'd always wanted to be paid. Somehow we worked it out this time where he didn't have to be, maybe through an agent or something.
So were there any surprises from Junior in the course of your talks?
There were some questions that arose, you know, about some of the recordings that I wasn't sure about, and I'm still not sure about, you know, a lot of, when you try to sort out discography in an interview, the details are always kind of fuzzy sometimes. But just kind of some of the stories of the way he came up with Muddy, and it may be things that have been printed here and there in different ways, but I just thought it was a good, he did a good job of telling it.
What was his mood like when you talked to him?
Well, we did one interview, we sat in a van outside the checkerboard for about an hour or two, and he's more than willing to talk. He was in the, you know, anything I asked, he was off and running. I think we did another interview at Checker Buddy Guys. I think he was trying to be earnest, you know, not being jive or boastful about stuff.
How deeply immersed was he in the artists that came before him?
Well, he had an appreciation for people like Tampa Red and Forest City Joe, and he was childhood friends with Junior Parker. I mean, that's not before him, but that's contemporary, but that's two artists that people wouldn't usually connect, I don't think, Junior Parker and Junior Wells, but they were actually boyhood friends in West Memphis. And of course, the first Sonny Boy, he was very influenced by him. So he did have an appreciation for what came before. He was one of the artists who helped kind of make it more contemporary, you know, as the years went on, too. So he has a good sense of the past and the future, so to speak.
I always find that delightful, guys that I think are great artists who also have a sense of the history. I've always shared that with Billy Boy.
I think Billy Boy Arnold is an amazing sense of, has an amazing sense of history and a perspective on the whole history, too. You know, he can tell you what happened when and how that influenced who and what that means now. You know?
Yeah, it's always stuff that like the last time I talked to him, he was telling me, now this is a wild story, that Blind John Davis and Big Joe Williams got into a fight at a recording session, and that Big Joe was being real belligerent, and Blind John stood up and slapped him and just totally cowed him and made him behave himself. And Big Joe, you know, he is regarded as a rough character in his own right, and this blind man slaps him down. You know? And I think we forget, actually, Blind John was a pretty big guy. If you always saw him sitting at a table or sitting somewhere, but that was sort of interesting.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with Blind John Davis, too, actually, and it came about through my interest in Tampa Red, but I ended up spending more time with Big John. I'd take him to gigs, and he called himself Big Johnny sometimes, too.
We talked about Junior Wells, Houston Stackhouse. Any other favorites?
Thomas Dorsey, and I was always glad we had interviewed him. Georgia Tom, who became known as the father of gospel music, as Thomas A. Dorsey, his real name. But he had done some of the most risque blues when he was a blues man, and then he became a revered gospel figure. But it was great talking to him because he didn't put the blues down in any way. You know, he always regarded it as just a valid way of expressing the human condition as blues was, as gospel was, both of them.
How did that interview take place?
I just called him, I believe, on the phone and asked could we come over to his house. And we went over a couple of times and interviewed him. And Amy had a radio show at different times during that period. And some of those interviews we would also tape for the radio. So Amy would kind of open the interviews with some more of the general kind of blues and biographical questions for a radio audience. And then we'd follow up and get into more of the details, like, do you remember Stovepipe Johnson, stuff like that.
So you would say that at this point, you both were knowledgeable enough to ask intelligent questions of Thomas Dorsey?
Well, we read what we could on him, so I suppose there's more we could have always asked, and, you know, that was one of my big regrets about interviewing Howlin' Wolf, was that at that point, we really didn't know enough to ask him any good questions. But as time went on, you know, the more research you do, and that helps in the interview, too, when you can dredge up some kind of obscure detail from an artist's past or some record they made that they might not have thought about in years, kind of to get things going a little better.
Yeah, you're always looking to hit that pilot light and get it going, huh?
Right. At that point, you know, we had a little bit easier than people do now because most of these artists hadn't been interviewed a lot. And now, with so many blues magazines and newsletters and radio shows and things, some of the interviews just become fairly stock, you know, questions and answers, and it gets fairly boring or even irritating to some of the artists sometimes, I think.
You mentioned something about the Amy show. What were Amy's programs called?
Amy started a blues show at Northwestern that was called Big Mama's Blues Show, and then when she got a show on, there was a couple of FM stations in Chicago, WXFM and WNIB. It was called Atomic Mama's Wang Dang Doodle Blues Show.
I remember before I even went to radio school, I think I listened to that. That was always interesting. So some of these interviews were actually done with broadcast in mind. Were any of these done in what you would regard as broadcast quality?
There were a few. Now, we actually had a reel-to-reel tape recorder at times, or occasionally it would tape things in the radio station. So a few of them survived on reel-to-reel, but mostly we were recording on the cheap cassette player, on as cheap cassettes as we could use, and it took me a little while to realize I shouldn't be taping over the interviews. I did lose a few of the very early ones that way. But.
Well, that probably in the early days, it was probably just erasing what might have been an embarrassment, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the thing that I really don't understand. Of course, I come from broadcast point of view, and in any interview that I do, I would like to have the best sound quality that I can get for use on the air.
We were a print medium, and so that our primary purpose was to get the words into print, so we weren't as concerned about the audio quality, although we didn't have, I would always liked it, but we didn't spend the money on it. I suppose I could have spent the money on a better system, but I spent the money on records.
I don't know that feeling, Jim. What are you talking about? I remember that you and Amy loaned me for use on the air on my program. I remember that an extensive Jimmy Reed interview?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I edited that down so it ran in what I thought was a coherent fashion for Jimmy Reed. That was. Yeah, I think it was you also loaned me the Eddie Boyd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then Dick loaned me Percy Mayfield. People, at that point, all these folks were gone, I believe. Would Jimmy die in 77?
I think Jimmy Reed died in 76, I believe, yeah. And that was another interview I was certainly glad we did, because he was, at that point in his career, he was fairly difficult to get to, not because he was difficult, but just circumstances of his life made it hard to pin him down.
Yeah, and you guys did a great job on that one. That and the Eddie Boyd. I thought those were wonderful interviews.
Eddie Boyd had just had so much to say. I mean, I didn't really have to. Some of the artists are such good interpreters or storytellers or commentators or historians themselves, you know, that you can just kind of let the tape roll and you'll get something great. Jimmy Reed took a lot of work, because I actually had to spend a lot of time trying to track him down and I stood outside in the snow for 2 hours one time listening to him play upstairs, and no one would answer the door.
Was he with Mama Reed at that point?
Jimmy wasn't with his family, with Mama Reed and them at that point. He was with Johnny Mae Dunson for a while, and then he lived with his cousin Levi Reed for a while after that.
Then some of the family members or some of the people act as an insulating agent from the rest of the world, trying to keep him, I think, out of trouble initially, but just basically sort of hide him out from everybody?
Yeah, I think Johnny Mae was real protective of him. He had epileptic seizures, and he had, of course, had a well-known alcohol problem in his earlier years, and although he had stopped drinking at the time that I met him. But I think there was a lot of effort made sure that he wouldn't be tempted again. So a lot of that was just keeping him away from everybody.
You know, on Sunday nights when I worked with Magic Slim at Josephine's, we played a late night Sunday thing, and Jimmy Reed would always show up there. He wore like a trench coat and white plastic shoes, and he would sit in the back table by himself and drink Coca-Colas all night.
Yeah, I remember he would go out to some clubs, but he seemed to have it under control. You know, we took a picture, the picture that became the cover of Living Blues. I don't believe the Pepsi cans were on it, but he was sitting in front of a mountain, a wall of Pepsi cans. And Johnny May's son was learning from him at the time, who's now a recording artist on his own, Jimmy Primetime Smith. So he was learning from Jimmy Reed and Eddie Taylor when he was 12 years old. So.
That guy's got the best drag beat, back in the pocket timing, Jim, of any guitar player I know that's out there these days. I had a gig with his mother. I set it up over at Bill's Blues. You would remember that we used to see him at Blues on Halsted and the matinee with Floyd and Walter. Was he in the middle of those two guys? And when he stepped up, I just couldn't believe it. It's like down home again. Somebody actually remembered how to play back in the pocket.
Yeah, it's funny with all the Jimmy Reed covers that you hear. You don't kind of everybody kind of misses out on what the rhythm really was.
As far back in the pocket as you can get. That's what made it lazy. Any real big disappointments? You know, fizzles on the launching pad.
Well, there were some interviews that people had done that we never got printed that I thought were good. There was a Clifton Chenier interview that Hammond Scott had done, and another one with Gapemouth Brown, which was real interesting and extensive, and they both got erased or something. But as far as people had tried to interview, I mean, some people aren't very talkative. Otis Rush isn't, or not usually. And so to do an interview with him, we kind of had to, I mean, we did interview him more than once, but interspersed the printed interview with quotes from other musicians to kind of fill it out. So, the ones who have the most to say with their music aren't always the ones who have the most to say in the conversation.
Had a brand new car. I had had fine clothes. Somebody asked me what he had. I don't know what it goes. Oh, baby. Things ain't what they used to be. Ain't no time you keep on. Things ain't what they used to be.
Let me remind you that you're tuned to Blues Before Sunrise. I'm your host, Steve Cushing, and we're listening to an extended interview with Jim O'Neill, who was one of the founders of Living Blues Magazine, also the editor and the owner of the Rooster record label. Let's get back to our interview.
Let's talk about Rooster Records. How did that whole thing come about?
I had managed to stay out of the record business for a while, and in retrospect, I guess I wish I had gotten into it earlier. but I had been helping out on occasion. Once in a while, I would go to a Del Mark session. Those were the first recording sessions I ever went to. I think Luther Allison and Junior Wells, some of those early Del Mark sessions. Sometimes companies would come to town. There was a label called MCM from France, which came to town in the mid-70s and wanted to record a whole series of albums, and they wanted to set up in the clubs and do it. And so I helped them with that. You know, helped to arrange some of that and take pictures for them. And also Ralph Bass, that was a noted record producer who recorded a series of blues albums in 1977. He had been very active with Chess and other labels earlier in his career, but he was sort of out of touch with the scene at that point, so he called Living Blues to ask who he should record. So I was able to get, you know, Jimmy Johnson and Magic Slim and Eddie Clearwater and Kerry Bell, a lot of other people recorded then. But I hadn't really done anything on my own, and the more I saw how some of these other sessions were being done, which was like give the artist two hours in the studio and tell them to record some blues, and that's kind of it. Or 2 hours on the bandstand in the club and recorded on the tape recorder. And I thought there were a lot of blues artists around town who either hadn't had a good representation of being recorded or hadn't been recorded at all. So it actually came about with some friends of ours from England. Mick and Phil Huggins came over, and they decided they would like to get involved in a record label. And they actually had $1,000. It was like starting Living Blues again with $300. We started Rooster Blues with $1,000, And so the artist I picked to do the first recording with was Eddie Clearwater, because I'd been seeing him a lot. I always liked him, and I thought he hadn't come near to record the kind of material that he could. So we recorded the Chief album then, and then followed that with Larry Davis and Magic Slim, Kerry and Larry Bell.
Those were the sessions that you held, but you also did a number of other. You were busy keeping the 45 alive.
Yeah, I always liked 45s. I still do. I wish they still made them. We did 45. Sometimes there were more collector's items, like we did a red vinyl Hound Dog Taylor 45, which is from an old session he had done for Cadillac Baby, and a blue vinyl Little Johnny Jones 45, which was an unissued test pressing or acetate I'd gotten from Little Johnny's widow, Lisa. And then we also put out some 45s. which once in a while, the idea for a 45 was to try to get them on the jukebox or the radio on a more commercial level or into the black community more than the white collectors community. And so once in a while, we had a little success with Larry Davis. When I moved to Mississippi, I did a 45 on Boober Barnes, and I always felt proudest of that I actually got to record a 45 that you could hear in a jukebox on Nelson Street in Greenville.
Wow. Where did the Billy the Kid Emerson thing come from?
Billy the Kid was one of those artists who was kind of off the scene when we got into it, and when I found him, got introduced to him somehow, and he was one of those artists who had a lot to say, a great recording history, and so did a Living Blues interview with him, and he had some tapes that he wanted to do something with. So he had some of Matt Murphy, and but mostly they were tapes of himself, and some of them with Lacey Gibson on guitar. We never did actually get around to doing a whole album on him because after that he got back into the church, and he became a preacher and said that the bishops, whoever, told him he shouldn't be messing with the blues anymore. Now he's in Florida, I think, now.
I actually tried to catch up with him. I was told that he spends the winters in Florida. Was it like in Tarpon, Florida? Is that
Tarpon Springs, yeah.
Yeah, Tarpon Springs. But he was actually at a church in Maywood for the last couple of years.
Oh, is that right?
And Lonnie Brooks.
Around somewhere, yeah.
And Lonnie Brooks stays in touch with him. He and Lonnie apparently are good friends, and Lonnie gave me a number for him in Florida, and I looked up the church where he was at in Maywood here, and I was sort of interested. I never did manage to make connection with him, though.
So. Yeah, he was the one who gave Lonnie the name Lonnie Brooks.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What is the status of Rooster Blues? How long did the label, did you actually have a hand in running the thing, and how did the whole thing proceed?
Well, Rooster Blues started in... The first sessions were in 1979. First records came out in 80. Originally, it was a partnership between Amy and me and Mick and Silla Huggins in England. And after two or three years of that, they decided, in England, they decided they'd had enough of it. You could see where the record business was going. But I thought we'd kind of gotten off to a good start with it, at least compared to the way things are now, or way things had developed later. Then after I moved to Mississippi, then I started focusing more on recording contemporary Delta blues like Booba Barnes and artists like that, Super Chicken and Willie Cobbs, who was in Arkansas. And I kept that going until I left Mississippi in 1998 after I'd gotten married and I had a couple of kids, and we moved to Kansas City where my wife was from. And really couldn't just keep the label going the way it was. In the past, it's kind of like the blues artists were part of the family, or if they needed money, I would loan them money and a place to stay or whatever. And then once I actually had a family with kids and stuff to support, it kind of got harder to keep the blues end of it going, at least on a business level that way. So we ended up selling the record label to blues fan and businessman named Robert Johnson from Connecticut. It looked like there was going to be a great future, because here was someone with money who loved the blues, who was willing to pay me to produce records, actually, and actually get paid for doing the records, what I wanted to do. But that only lasted a year or two until he saw the way blues sales were going. And it's been pretty much inactive for the last 4 years, I would say. So he's agreed to let me license some of the material back so I can put it out on a new label called Stackhouse, which is the name of a record store that I've had, and also, of course, the name of one of my favorite blues artists, Houston Stackhouse.
Let's talk about that. How did the whole idea of Stackhouse, the store, come about? What led to that? And what was it? Maybe you can explain to people.
Yeah. Well, I moved to Mississippi in 1986. After Living Blues got transferred to the University of Mississippi. That happened in 83 when the university started publishing the magazine, although I was still the editor. But I was still living in Chicago, and there were problems trying to coordinate the material and the content and all the different issues of the magazine. while I was in Chicago and the layout staff was in Mississippi. I guess it's done more often now. It's easier now with computers and internet, but at that time it wasn't. So I ended up moving to Mississippi to edit the magazine from there for a while, and that was in Oxford, Mississippi. But after a year of that, I decided I'd really done what I could with the magazine, and I went to the Delta, to Marigold, and then to Clarksdale, Mississippi, and started a store, you know, recording studio in a store called Stackhouse. Patty Johnson and I, she was my partner at that point, and we were looking around the Delta for a place to have a business, and ended up in Clarksdale because that's where it seemed like people were more interested in trying to develop something. And there was an old store there that had been called a cream boat. It was shaped like a steamboat with a couple of fake smokestacks on top of it. So we were trying to think of a name for it, something like smokestack. So Stackhouse came out of that, plus the fact that, of course, I'd been close to Houston Stackhouse, and I also knew his son, Houston Stackhouse Jr., in Helena, Arkansas, who was with the Blues Foundation in Memphis. So when we opened the store, they came over, the Stackhouse family came over for the grand opening. And we opened it on Muddy Waters' birthday in 1988. And T-Model Ford played at the opening, too, I think. T-Model, or maybe it was Ernest Roy Sr., maybe. One of the Delta Blues guitar players. So I stayed in Clarksdale then until I moved to Kansas City, operating the record store, and we put a studio in the back of the store and the record label.
What did you record in Stackhouse? What sessions actually took place there?
Willie Cobbs, Lonnie Pitchford, Lonnie Shields, Super Chicken, Big Jack Johnson, Monroe Jones, Robert Bilbo Walker, Jerry Ricks. On occasion, we would rent out the studio to other people who wanted to come in, and Jimbo Mathis recorded an album there. We also had another temporary studio across the street before we had that, and Eddie Shaw recorded there. Whenever there was enough money to pay musicians to come in and record and pay the engineer for a few hours, we'd try to do something. But so it was kind of a sporadic operation. When a bunch of money would come in from something, they would spend it right away recording. I used to spend it on records, and then I started spending it on sessions.
Let's talk it over, baby, before we start. I heard about the way you overdo your part, but don't you lie to me. I will give to you. I gave you all of my jelly if you give me yours too. But don't you lie to me. Don't you lie to me. It makes me mad and I get as evil as a man can be.
It's Little Johnny Jones and Don't You Lie to Me from 1964, featuring Lee Jackson on guitar. Before that, we had listened to Smokey Smothers and the Ice Cream Men from August 1981, and Things Ain't What They Used to Be. Smokey Smothers, slide guitar and vocal, and Mad Dog Lester Davenport on harmonica. You're tuned to Blues Before Sunrise. I'm Steve Cushing, and last hour and this hour, we're listening to an interview with Jim O'Neill, who was one of the founders of Living Blues magazine and its editor for a long time, also the owner of the Rooster label, where most of these records are coming from. Let's get back to our final segment of the interview with Jim O'Neill. Again, the interview took place July 28th of 2006 and is available in the book Pioneers of the Blues Revival by me, Steve Cushing, on the University of Illinois Press. Here we go with Jim O'Neill.
Was it you and Amy? Was it Amy who worked with Cadillac Baby?
We both used to go visit him. I don't know if we did much of a project with him. He went to the studio and did an album. What happened was, in my record collecting and interviewing adventures, I'd met Cadillac Baby, who had this label called BM Baby back in the 50s and 60s. He still had a little candy store where he had records for sale, 44th and State Street. He still had the stock of records, and he wanted to sell them, so he told him he could advertise them in the magazine. So he started advertising them, and people would write in, and he found out there was some interest, and then he decided he would do an album. So he announced in one of the ads in Living Blues that he ordered this album from Cadillac Baby. Then people started writing in, except the album didn't exist. So he decided he had to go into the studio and actually do something. So he got Sonnyland Slim and Willie Williams and Home Sweet James, maybe, and some others together, and went to the studio. And what he did while I was there was he wanted to make it seem like it was recorded live at his club. This is a club that he'd had a long time before that, which was no longer in business. But he announced that, you know, this is Cadillac Baby live from the show club in 1958.
Hey!
Right. And then the few of us who were there in the studio would applaud, you know, so we were the live audience. So he did finally put that album out. It came out pretty good, but it wasn't a live album like it.
Well, I mean, basically, it was the records that he'd put out before, tapes of the records he'd put out before.
Some of it was actually new recording. Then some older ones on it, too. And then a label from England, Red Lightning, licensed a lot of the older material from him, too, and put a series of albums out.
Let's talk about some of the blues people that you've met. Who was your favorite bluesman, would you say? I mean, is it possible to narrow it down to, like, a guy that just above all others you really liked?
Joe Willie Wilkins, I think, is probably just as a blues spirit and musician, and someone I think of a lot, someone I wish I could have recorded. He would have been the first person I recorded for Rooster Blues if he hadn't died that year. He was a guitar player in Memphis who had played with Sonny Boy Williamson in the earlier years, and Houston Stackhouse used to live at his house in Memphis, so I would go visit them, and that was, I guess maybe at that point in my career, they were the elder figures in my life that I looked up to, and he was just wonderful to be around, and did a lot more with his music than anybody ever heard, not on record. Ray King is someone who's inspirational to me today. I kind of get some kind of a feeling like that from him.
Would you tell me the story of your dealings with Willie Nicks?
Willie Nicks was one of those legendary figures who'd recorded back in the 50s for Sun and Chess and RPM and Chance and Sabre. And he had disappeared from the scene. I think he'd been in prison or gotten into something else, and had resurfaced in the early years of Living Blues when Steve LeVere found him in Memphis. Steve LeVere used to be one of the regular contributors to Living Blues in the early years, too. And he'd done an article on him, and then he just kind of dropped out of sight again. And it was actually through Joe Willie Wilkins several years later that I found out that Willie Nicks was still around. Joe Willie had a piece of paper that Willie Nicks had written his name on, and the town that he wrote on the piece of paper was Leader, L-E-A-T-E-R, Mississippi, which actually was Leland, Mississippi. Somehow I deciphered that. And so I went to I went down to Leland. I was living in Chicago, but I would make these regular trips down to Memphis and Mississippi just to interview people and report on what was going on. Willie Nix was what Lee Jackson, the Chicago guitar player, always described him as, a little aviatic, which means a little flighty maybe, or in a different world, or had a different mindset than the average person. But he was quite a character. He could recite the jive poetry, you know, long and lean, ain't never had nothing, that kind of stuff. And I drove around Leland with him, and just around the countryside, he just wanted to show me some stuff. And we'd stop and visit some people, and he was, most of the people around Leland just knew him as a wino. You know, they didn't think anything about him being a musician or that he'd ever been famous. So he, you know, he had been famous. You know, Robert Jr. Lockwood played in his band, and you know, he was a pretty big name back in around 1950, 51, down there. Nobody believed anything like, and so we'd stop and there'd be a bunch of guys hanging out somewhere, and we would get out of the car and say, look, he came all the way to see me. See, look at his car. You can tell he ain't from around here. I'm telling you, I made records. and I'd say, yeah, he did. You know, I'd try to verify that, you know, that he had, the people overseas knew who he was and everything. He just never really had much of a career down, you know, in the later years at all. I heard him play a little bit of guitar at his house. He had learned guitar from Joe Willie Wilkins. He actually sounded almost just like him. He was better known as a drummer, but that's what he did on his records. He sang and played drums with people like Walter Horton, Willie Johnson, a lot of great Chicago and Memphis musicians. He actually moved to Clarksdale after years later. He stayed in Leland all this time. This was in the 70s when I went see him the first time. Then after I moved to Clarksdale, he decided he would come there and he wanted to make a record, wrote some new songs. Look out, all you young hookers, Willie Nix is in town. But he made friends with another friend of mine who was a DJ down there, Andy McWilliams, and Andy would go around with him places, and Willie Nix would tell him that he wanted to, like, set up in front of the Chinese grocery store and play. Because that's the way they used to do it. That's the way they used to get crowds. You know, this is back 40, 50 years ago. Things were in Willie Nix's mind, it was still like that. In the end, it was kind of sad. You know, nobody knew much about him when he died. You know, we just heard that he died in 1991, I think, in Leland.
Tell me about the time that you spent with Ike Turner, how that happened and what went on there.
Yeah, I always had admiration for Ike Turner's music, you know, regardless of what's happened with his personal life. You know, he's a pretty notorious character, but I always thought his contributions to music, both to blues and rhythm and blues and rock and roll, have not often been acknowledged as much as they should have been. So I first went to Los Angeles. I knew he was living out there. I made a trip out there and went to the address I had for Bollock Sound Studios, but it had burned down. The building was still there, but there were still master tapes inside, but they were all charred and burned. Couldn't find him that trip. And then a couple of years later, I heard he moved to East St. Louis briefly for a while to try to make a comeback there. This was after he and Tina had split up. So I did end up spending a few days with him at the house where he had there in East St. Louis. There were musicians coming in and out, and he was like, I would try to talk to him, try to interview him, and he would sit still for a little while, but he was always going a mile a minute and trying to go this place and that and do something, and he couldn't understand why anyone would want to know about all that old stuff, you know, because he was always trying to find something new that was going to be a hit. And I kept in touch with him over the years. He moved back to L.A., back to that area, and finally, when I made the deal with Rob Johnson to the Rooster Blues, I introduced Rob to Ike Turner and been trying to get Ike to do a blues album, and Ike had pretty much done it on his own. I didn't really have anything to do with it except kind of making that connection so that he could get that album out, but that kind of did put him on a blues path. Actually, I just got a new CD in the other day in the mail from him. It's another all-blues album called Rising with the Blues. Well, the thing I find about Ike is despite all the the violent image and all the, you know, the criminal associations or whatever, or abuse associations, that he's actually a fairly shy person underneath and can be very funny and entertaining to be around. On the one hand, a lot of people have a great fondness for him, and of course other people wouldn't trust him either, so.
Interesting. Okay.
I remember going with the piano player Jimmy Walker one time to see Hotbox Johnson, who was a guitar player who recorded back in the early days. He played on some Curtis Jones records and was supposed to be a great guitar player. I never actually got to see him. But we went, Jimmy Walker knew where he was. He was a friend of his. So I went with Jimmy Walker one day and to this apartment building, and Jimmy walked up to the top of the stairs, and I could hear him talking. He wouldn't let us in. So there were those people who had had enough of the blues world and didn't want any more to do with it. So some we never got to meet, but I did hear him talk.
And there you have it. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Jim O'Neill. He's one of the founders and the editor of Living Blues Magazine, based here in Chicago, also the owner, operator of the Rooster Record label. Again, the interview was done back in July 28th, 2006, and is available in print form in the book Pioneers of the Blues Revival. It's one of 19 different interviews with some of the white enthusiasts who help to make blues popular in modern culture here. To finish out the hour, let's listen to some sides around the Rooster label. Let me remind you also that this is daylight savings time. We fall back in the fall. That means there's an extra hour, 6 hours of blues before sunrise. So there's still plenty more to come. Here's Magic Slim and the Teardrops.
just come on home to me. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody. Somebody gonna love me. You eat grits, go to the grocer's. You eat fish, look to the sea. You need love, baby, don't go no further. Just come on home to me. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody. Somebody gonna love me. You eat apples, look to the trees. You need love, baby, don't go no further. Just come on home to me. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody, Sarah. Somebody gonna love me. Just ring my number, just come on home to me. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody. I got to love somebody. Somebody gonna love me.
I think you've been smoking that pipe, girl.
Got rolls up, baby. Just won't treat me right. You got my nose up, baby. Just won't treat me right. Take all of my money and you walk the streets all night.
treat me right.
Harp man Arthur Williams, and You Got My Nose Open, Baby, on the Rooster label, thing called Midnight Blue from July 2001. Before that, we had Mojo Buford from February of 1979, and Don't Go No Further. And we started the set with Magic Slim and the Teardrops from May of 1975, and Wonder Why. You're tuned to Blues Before Sunrise. It's the Blues Heritage Showcase. I'm Steve Cushing. We're going to pause and identify the station. Don't forget, for those of you that observe daylight savings time, there's still two more hours of our program to come your way. So you sit tight. We'll identify the station and be back with next hour Blues Before Sunrise.